Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us Los Angeles screenwriter and actor Ariadne Schaefer. She has found herself in all corners of the film industry. As an actor, her work has been seen at Cannes, Sundance, and the Toronto Film Festival. Her screenwriting has placed with the Nicole Fellowship, Page Awards, Right Movies, Tracking Bee, CineStory, and StoryPro screenwriting contests. She has also produced a short for ITVS, the internet wing of PBS. In her day-to-day work, she is the controller for both Castle Rock and Imagination Worldwide. She is very excited that her feature script, The Neverlist, was shot in Los Angeles in September 2018. It was produced by Imagination Worldwide, with Michelle Moore directing and Anna Margarita El Bello producing. It stars Fievel Stewart from Atypical, Jonathan Bennett from Mean Girls, and Kiko Ajina from Gilmore Girls. Welcome to our program, Ariadne.
Thanks.
It's good to have you here. I'm sorry I stumbled over your name a little bit. It's unusual to me. And you have pre-program explained to me that it's, well, maybe you should tell our listeners where your name comes from.
All right. My father was an amateur classicist. So all the books in the house were on ancient Greece and Rome. And my name's Ariadne, which is an ancient name. She was the wife of Dionysus. And before that, the princess of Knossos. My sister's name is Cassandra, the dog's name is Vesta, the cat's name is Pandora. We were all named out of myth books.
Well, it makes me laugh, but it's so wonderful because I think your life was dramatic from day one. So it doesn't surprise me that you're in screenwriting and acting.
Indeed.
I know from our discussions before the program that you were from a tiny town in Montana, which must have been another very interesting place to have a family with classical Greek names. And then you spent your formative years in Seattle. You attended the University of Washington, majoring in theater and comparative history of ideas. So I'm going to ask it. Maybe it's an easy question, maybe it's a hard one, but how does it feel to have left a tiny town to move to Seattle and then on to L.A.?
The tiny town to Seattle was basically, I switched back and forth between them as a kid. My dad always lived in, it's Libby, Montana, which is a little mining town in the Rockies, and Seattle was where I went to school. So I always had both of those in my childhood, and then moving to L.A., I moved in when I was 27, I actually really took to it immediately. I love just how much is going on and how many different kinds of people. And I still have a deep love of Seattle and the whole Northwest, but I really love the energy of Southern California and of LA. And I love it down here.
And there's lots of sun, right?
There's lots of sun, although I actually am probably one of the only people who, I'm here more for the people than for the sun. I actually really love rainy days and storms, and I miss that a lot. But I just really love the crowds and the bustle and the everybody doing something exciting. So I think that's a very strange thing to say, but yet it's true. I'm here for the people, not the weather.
All right. So when you first went to L.A., I think you went as an actor. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Exactly.
And then you've moved now. Your love is writing the screenplays for the actors to act in.
Exactly.
How did that transition work? And I'm going to assume that your acting years have helped you in writing the screenplays.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had acted both in stage. There's actually a lot of small theater down here in L.A. and film for many years, and a lot of independent films, some smaller things in big shows, but mostly I had done independent films. And then when my daughter was born, I kind of looked at her and was like, oh, I think it's about time I do something with my life. That, to me, was to start to tell my own stories. So acting became very difficult after she was born because of the time it takes both to get the work and then to do the work. And so that also inspired me to maybe go and move to writing. I was talking about moving to writing with one of my friends who'd been to film school, and I was like, oh, I think I'm going to go take a class or something. And he said, hey, I can teach better than any of those guys. They don't know what they're talking about. And I said, cool, then teach me. We set up a deal where I'd pay him a little bit, and we met once a week, and we'd drink a beer at a nearby restaurant, and Costa would take care of Keziah, our daughter, my husband, Costa, and we would sit around and drink beer and talk about screenwriting.
So you had a private tutorial.
I did for a couple of years.
I could ask you how the beer influenced your writing, but I'd rather talk about how being an actor influenced the way you approach screenwriting.
Well, first of all, it was part of my inspiration because I had been a writer in high school and college, and then I gave it up and just did acting for many years. I went to actually a WGA event, and there were a bunch of speakers there, and one of them said that she got into writing because she had been an actress, and she was like, wow, I can write better than this crap that I'm getting. And I was like, oh, that's true. I'm getting really terrible scripts. I can write better than this. That was Audrey Wells, who I heard speaking. And she actually put a post-it on her computer that said, write some crap today. And I was inspired to do the same thing. I just got a post-it and I wrote it on, I put it on my computer. It said, write some crap today. Somehow, by not feeling like I was going to write something good, like not putting my, having huge, a hugely high standard, I was able to feel free to write. And I was inspired because, again, I'd done so many terrible scripts. I was like, I absolutely have a right to write this because I see what's out there. And then, yeah, as an actor, I'd spend a lot of years learning how to be honest and how also to have a quick repartee. And so all of that fed into my writing, as well as knowing how to write things that actors would want to do. And that is actually very useful when you're trying to get actors to be in your screenplay.
So that's really interesting to me, especially the word honest, which I think you meant applied to acting as well as then to writing scripts for actors.
Yeah.
And what does that mean exactly? Do writers... how do they stray from the truth? How do their scripts sound inauthentic, the ones that aren't good?
Well, I can't really speak to other writers, but for me, what I found is when I was not being honest, it was like I was writing how I thought a script should sound or a screenplay. Like I was writing a version of what I'd seen on screen or stage. And when I was honest, I was writing from my own experience, from the people I knew, from the things I wanted to say about the world.
When an actor says, I see terrible scripts, I can write better than this, what are they seeing in the script? That it's derivative? Is that one thing?
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. It's derivative, that it, and also that it's not actually dealing with an interesting issue about life. You know, it's not actually, to me, a screenplay, to some extent, is asking a question about what it is to be human, and then processing the question. The scripts that I was doing were not. They were just like, can I get this produced? Can I get some money for this? It was, and, oh, this is like this other script, which made it big, so therefore maybe this will make it big.
I see.
Rather than being honest to the writer's personal experience and asking something that they needed to know the answer to with the script.
And therefore, as an actor is acting, and they're in a learning process as well, it sounds like. And that would affect their acting.
Right. Yes, totally.
Those of us who are artists are in it for the wisdom that we can gain, I think, rather than the money. And that leads me to want to talk to you about the Never List. And I hope you're prepared to read what you can of
us. Yeah, I am actually.
Right? Would you like to tell us anything about the story first or just afterwards?
Yeah. The Never List is a young adult story, and it's about a junior in high school, a girl who's been a good student all her life. She's college bound, she's on student council, she's doing all the right things, taking all the right classes, but she kind of secretly wants to be a graphic novelist, but she knows her parents don't want that. That's not, and so she's kind of hiding that side of herself. And she has a best friend who has been her best friend forever and is also on that same track. But the two of them have always had these secret identities, Vicky and Veronica, who is kind of who they wish they could be. And they have a list that they keep called the Never List, which is all of the things that Vicky and Veronica would do, but they never would. And they kind of sound like fun. And they've been keeping this list since they were kids, doing a new one every couple of years. And in the course of the story, fairly early on, the best friend dies tragically in a car accident. And our hero, Eva, decides to do everything on the most recent version of the Never List in honor of her friend who never got a chance. So that's what the story is. And this is a scene between Eva and Liz from early on. And they're sitting in a park, so it's exterior park day. Liz slash Vicky and Eva slash Veronica sit in the park. Oh, they dress up as these alter egos as well. Liz, we could rob a bank. Eva, we already did that in seventh grade, remember? Liz, did we? Eva reaches into her backpack and pulls out a binder. She opens it to reveal dozens of Never Lists from years past, all placed in protective plastic sleeves and organized by year. Liz points to the first one written on a piece of colorful paper. Aw, look at how cute her handwriting was in second grade. The words "the Never List" are carefully printed on the top in a second grader's handwriting. Some items from the list. 1, steal candy. 2, free all the dogs in the pound. 3, put worms in boys' lunchbox. 4, go on a roller coaster 5 times in a row. Eva shuffles the pages until she reaches a list with slightly more mature handwriting. 1, sneak beer. 2, hide in theater and watch the same movie 10 times in a row. 3, shoplift. 4, run away. 5, rob a bank. Eva, here, see, rob a bank. Liz, too bad. That would have been the perfect way to pay for Aaron Moon's class. The girls think hard as they sip unicorn frappuccinos. The Never List is written in a comic book-style lettering at the top of a sheet of paper. Below it, 6 items are listed. 1, pinch a stranger's ass. 2, skip class. 3, get into a fight. 4, sneak out. 5, steal a car. 6, get a tattoo. Liz, oh, got it. Vicky and Veronica could sell drugs. Eva, what? No way. Veronica would never. Neither would I. Liz, ergo the name. The Never List. We aren't actually going to do any of this stuff. Eva, but still, Veronica isn't a drug dealer. Liz, what about pot? It's legal now. Eva, fine. Liz writes, 7, sell pot. Eva, so we have Vicky and Veronica skipping class, sneaking out of school, stealing a car to get a tattoo, sell drugs, and end up getting into a fight. Liz, because someone punched the wrong guy's ass. They share a conspiratorial laugh. Eva, you're so bad. Liz, no, Vicky and Veronica are. Looking at her phone, crap, you better go. Theo's game will be over soon.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is speaking with former Seattle resident Ariadne Schaefer about her work as a screenwriter in Los Angeles.
So this whole scene is outside on a bench with their frappuccinos. Mm-hmm. And it's fun, as you can hear in this scene, how the girls, when they put all the things on the current Never List, how it has a narrative, you know, it goes through time as if they could do all of this in one fell swoop. And I don't think that's something they would have done when they were younger with their younger lists. Of course, you're leaving us wanting to see how the surviving friend manages to do all that and how she feels and how she honors Eva. Is that who she's honoring? Do I have that right?
No, it's Eva's the lead and Liz is the one she's honoring.
So Liz, it sounds like a fun adventure. And one of the, I mean, sad, but fun. And also a growth story, a story about accepting life on its own terms and coming through. That's how I understand it from the one scene. So it strikes me that how well envisioned this is. We know what the list looks like, the print of it. We know where they're sitting. We know what they're carrying. In your experience, what would happen in the hands of a director and actors with that scene? Would there be more added? Would there be anything taken away? How much does a screenwriter put in that's necessary for understanding the characters and the situation, and how much will it change?
It's very interesting because as a screenwriter, certainly I'm where I've been because I write spec scripts and then I try to get a producer or director interested. So your first version of the script is written to some extent to be read because you're looking for someone to read it and be able to see what you see in your head well enough to imagine how this could be on screen. So you're going to include a bunch of things so that the story plays out for the person in the same way it plays out for you, more or less. But yes, once it actually gets into the hands of the director, it can be completely rewritten, which was a bit kind of surprising. Sometimes in a good way. Sometimes they think of things that you never would have. Sometimes in a practical way, we can't possibly shoot in that location. We need to figure out another. Like, this was actually supposed to be in a cafe. Oh. Our budget was so small that it was just too expensive to put it into a cafe. So all the cafe scenes, because there were a number, there was a cafe that was like where they hung out, all cut out, and it all now takes place in a park. Then when you actually get it into the hands of the actors, they can adjust the lines, often in fantastic ways. I had amazing actors. I was really shocked. They were like some of the best actors I've ever worked with. And it was such a compliment to have them working on my words. And so sometimes they would add or improv or add little bits to the end. But it was absolutely, without exception, fantastic what they added, because they all understood the characters so much. And one of the really great things about writing a screenplay is you're basically, or even this is true of a play too, you're basically building a playground. You build it as well as you can, and you kind of put in ideas of how things can be played with. But then when the actors and the director and the crew come in, they may go, oh, actually, I could climb up the slide instead of slide down it. And you're like, whoa, that looks really fun. That's cool. Definitely. So it becomes more than just one person can envision. So I'm always so sad when directors are like, I wish I could control the actors better. Like, you're missing an opportunity there. Just hire actors that you like to play with and who do things that you think are cool, and let them be them.
It's what makes collaboration alive.
Mm-hmm.
I love the metaphor of the playground and climbing up the slide instead of sliding down. So I know in your background is your high school years. You've told me you interned or volunteered at theater groups in Seattle. And that means, I think, that you must have seen a lot of plays. And I'm wondering, when you sit down to write a screenplay and when you were taught to write a screenplay, how does it differ from, do you think, writing a stage play?
Well, I actually originally had wanted to be totally a stage person. I worked at ACT Theater in Seattle. And I actually was lucky enough to work, not volunteer. That was my high school job.
Oh.
From the time I was 16 until I was 22. I think I did it through college as well. I heard Christmas Carol hundreds of times. And I could sneak in the back and watch the performance. And so that was definitely my first love and where I thought I'd be. And I did write a number of plays. What I found, though, is that, first of all, I work in miniature. You can have small moments in plays, definitely, and there's wonderful plays like that. But a lot of the small moments work better on screen. And I had my writing teacher in college said, when you sit down to write a script, think about what is the best medium for it. If it's a musical with people on unicycles, then might be stage. That sounds fun on stage. If it's small, intimate moments of people talking to each other, that could possibly work on stage, but it might do better on screen. And as I went along, I found that both my acting and my writing worked better, kind of were more screen-oriented. The thing that was hard for me to kind of get out of was the one set and the small location, and one location or a few locations. The freedom, because I came to it from stage, of being able to go anywhere and do anything definitely took some getting used to. And also the length of the scenes. On stage, you tend to have longer scenes because transitions are dead time generally and can slow down a play. But on screen, you can slip back and forth immediately from a park to a cafe to wherever so fast. So you have complete freedom to go wherever. And so those things were definitely hard for me to get used to, as well as how much control, both control and lack of control, you have as a screenwriter. As a stage writer, you're never allowed to say, how the actor says something, frustrated, or she stands up and yells. You don't really get to include those things. That's up to the director and the actors. That's their purview. But because you're writing a screenplay originally to be read by someone hoping to get them to put money into it, you write it with all of this, the directions, almost like you're a director. Not with camera angles or anything like that, but certainly how the actors, the general sense of how an actor could play something or what physical business they're doing. She sips her coffee. She slams her cup down angrily. It's both a lot of freedom, but it was definitely a learning curve.
That's really interesting. That would lead me to the question of adaptations. I have heard from people that I know in the industry that at least a few years ago, adaptations were all the rage in terms of what they were looking for in screenplays. Is that, I don't know if that's still true, but that's a challenge, isn't it, to take something that's written as a novel or even a short story and create it for film.
I actually have kind of personal connection to this right now because I recently pitched at a production company here a fairly successful novel. I can't talk about what it was. So to prepare for it, I read the novel several times, and I walked in and there were so many post-its and tags and so forth, analyzing the characters and trying to figure out what would be included and what wouldn't be included, and how to cut this fairly big story, an ensemble story, number of different characters, down to still an ensemble story, but to have their story be as succinct as possible so that it could happen in an hour and a half. And even sometimes thinking about how to add things to the story to make sure that the arc that is in the book could show up on the screen in a way that would make sense visually. Especially considering in the book, we were dealing with stuff that was happening to people who, like, they were, because you get to go into long interior monologues. So they were processing things that had happened to them in the past. Can we avoid flashbacks? How do we keep it active? How do we keep it happening in front of people? And one of the characters was a writer. How do you keep the writer character as active as possible and their struggles? But you don't want to watch them sitting and writing because that's pretty close to one of the most boring things you could ever see on screen. Definitely, there's still adaptations are still a big thing because it's so hard to get an audience for film. And that's something I'm really seeing. Trying to get people to go see small film is incredibly difficult. And there's not a lot of money to be made on it. So therefore, if something has been proven, if a story has already been proven because it's sold a lot of books, then A, you know it's the kind of story that connects to people. And B, there's a good possibility all those people who bought the book are going to come out and see it. So definitely adaptations are a way for smaller stories to get onto the screen. For me, it was really fun, actually, to live in a world someone else had created and try to figure out how to bring it and make it visual. It was like almost had elements of a puzzle to it, which was neat, which I liked.
I do a lot of editing, and it's the same thing. It's like, how can I make what's encased in unnecessary words, not that the novel had unnecessary words, but for film, they would be, and make it come alive. And it's an extraordinary thing to do with your mind. I really enjoy doing
that. It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I get kind of impatient with people say, oh, I saw the film. It wasn't as good as the book. Well, they're different. They're really different. But if there's some wisdom that can come out of it, if there's some discovery, then it's really worthwhile. And in your point of view, it's about interesting people in what you're calling small films. So what if our listeners want to write a screenplay or want to get a screenplay to the attention of people in Los Angeles?
Contests actually did me quite well. Because one of the things you have to do without an agent, you can't get an agent without kind of, agents don't read submissions. So you can't get an agent, you can't get a manager. It's incredibly hard. But contests give you a stamp of approval that is incredibly helpful. There's one contest I'm going to do a call out for. It's called CineStory. I just did it this last year, and it's a 4 or 5 day retreat in the mountains near here. That was the best contest I've ever applied to, and the notes I got out of that are fantastic. So contest. Also, the fact that I placed in the Nickel contest, which doesn't mean anything to the average person, but the Nickel contest is the screenwriting contest connected to the Academy Awards. So definitely apply to that one, because the moment that you've ever had a screenplay that placed with the Nickel, that gives you immediate credibility. And then there are two websites, one called Inktip and one called Blacklist, the Blacklist, where you can list your screenplays online. I listed the Neverlist on Inktip, and that's how I found my director. And I listed a newer script that I have, Postscript, on the Blacklist, and just this year found a producer and a manager. So those two websites are accessible, obviously, from anywhere in the world. So all of those things can be done from wherever you live and are a great way to connect. And then I would also recommend, in terms of books, I would recommend Save the Cat. I would also recommend one that almost no one ever talks about is called The Virgin Promise. It's a fantastic book that looks at screenplay structure and characters through the standpoint of Jungian archetypes. And I just think she's brilliant. She doesn't get called out as often as other screenwriting books do, but I really think she's amazing.
It sounds like the internet is, again, a powerful tool for writers. So we're lucky we have it. And thank you for all of the resource information. So before we end our conversation, we need your website.
I don't have one.
You don't? So how can people find out more about your work?
Well, at this point, IMDb is the best way. But you know what? Maybe I'm inspired. Maybe I'll set up a website.
Well, it would be fun for us to be able to find you.
Wonderful.
But I know I did a search, and I did see you listed on a lot of the movie websites, and it was exciting to see your name there. So I want to thank you so very much for this conversation. I've learned a lot. I have a renewed interest in screenwriting and also just in why we write. So I thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.